10 years ago this week, Tahrir Square in Cairo was the most optimistic place on earth. It wasn't the first blossoming of the Arab Spring, that wave of Middle Eastern revolutions which began in Tunisia in late 2010, but it was potentially the most important. Mighty Egypt, with its vast population and colossal influence, summoning the nerve to overthrow the military dictatorship which had stifled it for decades. It looked like the Middle East's Berlin Wall moment, the sudden, exhilarating collapse of a repressive and dysfunctional political order. It was, at best, a partial success. Tahrir Square did prompt the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak after 30 years in power, which seemed nearer 300, and paved the way for Egypt's first ever meaningful presidential election in 2012. But this was won not by any liberal Democrat, but by the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, a conservative Islamist. And Morsi lasted barely a year before a coup d'état removed him and installed General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, another khaki-clad autocrat. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. 10 years on, is any trace of the Arab Spring still detectable in Egypt? Where did it all go wrong? And could it have been different? Perhaps most importantly, might it, could it, happen again? This is the Foreign Desk.
And we could see the crowds of protesters coming down one end of the street. And on the other end of the street came the riot police. And we'd seen them time and again, and how at the least little provocation, they'd arrest young Egyptians, they would disperse them, they'd use violence, and you held your breath. What would happen now?
All the artists are living in Berlin. Most of writers are in exile all over the world. Most of thinkers and even like lecturers, university professors, are living abroad or thinking about leaving the country. If you want to know what is happening in the Egyptian art scene, you will go to Berlin, not Cairo.
From the side of Europe, he waves the card of refugees, saying that if things go out of hand like Syria, Egypt is 100 million people. If those are unleashed, you wouldn't want to be in a situation that you have like four times the crisis that happened in Syria.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. First of all, let's return to the Tahrir Square of January 2011. Among the correspondents who descended to report on Egypt's uprising was Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent of the BBC.
Well, bear in mind that many of us, let us say, among the foreign correspondents, arrived in Tahrir Square, Liberation Square, from Tunisia, where it all began, this so-called, romantically called, Arab Spring. And so we came to Cairo infused with, and excited, it has to be said, by what we had already seen in Tunisia, to walk down that elegant tree-lined boulevard, Bourguiba Avenue, in the middle of Tunis, and to hear people say, for the first time in their lives, we have lost our fear. To see the protesters, young and old, running the gauntlet against security forces. To see people celebrating as they peacefully brought down the authoritarian president of Tunisia. Then we went to Cairo. And Cairo, the young Egyptian activist there, and indeed in capitals and towns and villages across the Middle East and beyond, they were watching this ferment, this talk of revolution, the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia. And so to be then on January the 25th, when it all started in Cairo, not first in Tahrir Square, but in the streets of Cairo, was an extraordinary moment with Egyptian activists who, like the Tunisians, especially a new, young, educated generation, daring to believe they could bring about peaceful change. You could feel it in the air. And I'll remember this first moment on January the 25th, being, there was so much tear gas, we went to the top of the building where the BBC office is. And it's also the office of many other journalists in Cairo. And we looked down to the street below and we could see the crowds of protesters coming down one end of the street. And on the other end of the street came the riot police with their helmets, with their shields. And we'd seen them time and again, and how at the least little provocation, they'd arrest young Egyptians, they would disperse them, they'd use violence. And you held your breath. What would happen now? And the Egyptian crowds held their nerve. There was a standoff, but they didn't run away and they weren't dispersed in the way that we had seen before. And that's how it all began. And then Tahrir Square became the gathering point. And in those early days, in those first tentative days where Egyptians were wondering and watching what was going to happen in Egypt? Would it be like Tunisia? Would it be different? My memory of Tahrir Square was of a gathering moment, that the crowds day by day would get larger and larger. You saw families, you saw children, you saw women coming out in large numbers in ways they had never come out before. And they all felt that they had a place in what became ground zero for this growing momentum, this growing uprising in Egypt, the second one across the Middle East. They were very proud that this was a movement without a leader, a leaderless revolution. They would say our problem in Egypt, and in fact you heard it not just in Egypt but elsewhere, especially among this new generation, our problem has been these leaders for life. Let's not choose our leaders. In the first place, if we choose our leaders, they will be knocked down or they will be taken away. Let us have the uprising of all the voices. So you heard about bread. You heard Hurra, freedom. There were these incredibly powerful phrases. We have lost our fear, the downfall of the regime, and perhaps the most electric one of all, the power of the people is greater than the people in power. The mood in Tahrir Square was absolutely electric. Remember, almost commensurate with the extraordinarily unprecedented nature of what had happened, the bringing down peacefully of the leader for life, Hosni Mubarak, it all happened in such a small sweep of time, from January the 25th to February the 11th, just 18 days. It was as if history had just been telescoped into these extraordinary days. And in those days, while there were moments of tension when the security forces came in, there were moments of danger between the protesters and the riot police, there were also times when women felt a little bit threatened. But for the most part, it seemed like this little oasis where families would come, women would come in groups because they felt safe in this square. The square was the square of the people. It was the gathering place for all of the emotions and expectation and anticipation of a people who'd never had a taste of this kind of political freedom. And I remember being in Tahrir Square, who could ever forget it, most of all the Egyptians, on February 11th.
In these difficult circumstances, the country is passing by. President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down. President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down as president of Egypt, and he has decided that the higher council of the armed forces will lead the nation.
When this noise came up from the crowds, Mubarak has stepped down, Mubarak is leaving, and the crowds just erupted in this celebration and these cries of joy. But of course, within that emotion and unparalleled joy, there was also this sort of sense of danger that things could get out of hand. And after February 11th, with every month that passed, that extraordinary character of this extraordinary square kept receding away. That by the end of the year, women were worrying about sexual assaults. By the end of the year, there was worry about the violence in the square. By the end of the year, people, activists were asking whether they were already losing the revolution that they thought had been their own. So it happened very quickly, and it unraveled very quickly. And it will take a very long time for Egyptians, especially for Egyptians young and old, who gave everything, and many of them lost everything in pursuing their dreams for political change.
That was the BBC's Lise Doucette remembering Tahrir Square. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm joined now by Nancy O'Kale and Ahmed Naji. Nancy O'Kale is a visiting scholar at Stanford University and former executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She was sentenced in absentia to 5 years imprisonment by an Egyptian court in 2013 as part of a crackdown on NGOs working in Egypt, and now lives in Washington, D.C. Ahmed Naji is a journalist and novelist. He spent most of 2016 in an Egyptian prison after a court ruled that one of his books violated public modesty. He now lives in Las Vegas. Obviously, the reason for this episode is to look back at that extraordinary outpouring of optimism in Egypt 10 years ago and look at where Egypt has gone since. But Ahmed, I'll start with you. If you go back, thinking back to 10 years ago, what your 10 years ago self might have replied if somebody had asked you, what do you think Egypt will be like 10 years from now?
I had a big hopes after February, after Mubarak falling down. And then my hopes went a little bit down after March. And I just like hoped at least like torturing at police station will stop. I didn't imagine we will have like a perfect democratic system or regime, but at least I imagine the possibility of ending police brutality and the possibility for moving towards more free society and more free regime and system. This was my hope. This was like my biggest dream, actually.
Do you have a recollection of a particular point at which you first thought maybe this isn't going to go like we hoped? I'm just trying to get a sense of how long that optimism lasted.
In my case, it lasted for only 1 month, because in March we had like what they called like the constitution reform. And I opposite said, like, we had two buses after Mubarak falling down. Like, this is what happened in Tunis. Like, they had an election for parliament and then another election to write the constitution. And then, like, you start to build the whole system from the scratch. But what happened in Egypt is that we didn't go to this path. We went to, like, constitution reform. And the picture started to get clear that there is, like, a cooperation between the military and Muslim Brotherhood. And I felt that we need to work on transition justice. This didn't happen. So everything went under the carpet, as we may say. After that, a couple of months, I left the country and I moved to Germany. And I lived there for a year because like I felt like it's not going to be well and it's going to be a chaos and more blood. But then I returned it back in 2012.
Well, just to follow that up, when you went back as early as 2012, was any of that optimism left, or had people by that point, notwithstanding that first democratic election, started to worry that the revolution really wasn't going to go anywhere?
Well, in 2012, things started to change, like the narrative of like the revolution and changing everything now changed. Like now we have a parliament, we have an election, we are talking about like kind of democratic process that is was going to happen. There was many parties, so people and revolutionary who used to be inactive. Now they entered like all these political parties and political movement. And yeah, it was chaos, it was violence, but at least you could feel there is a resistance. And for me, returning back, it was important because suddenly you feel you can be involved in what is happening and build with people that you agree with to try to build a movement to change and to force your idea, which is not necessarily like political idea. Like I was more interested and active in like spreading and promoting ideas related to freedom of expression, gender ideas, queer ideas. And I believed at this point, like focusing on like social and culture stuff is more important, more helpful to build a resistance, especially at that time against the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamistic, who had like huge fund and money pouring from like Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. So we need to establish a narrative against this narrative.
Nancy, if we look at Egypt now, 10 years later, does it strike you that that energy that was unleashed 10 years ago still exists in Egypt anywhere? It's obviously illustrative of something that both of you no longer live in Egypt. Does any of that spirit, I guess, of 2011 still exist anywhere back at home?
Well, actually, Egypt is in a very dark moment in terms of freedoms, in terms of dignity, in terms of the economic situation, which is actually what people went to the streets to resist and fight. And looking at the situation right now, as everybody knows and follow the news and see the thousands of people who are in prison, and that all voices that were having sort of a leading role at the time of the revolution in 2011 are actually in jail or exiled. And those who are not are banned from traveling, and it's very difficult for anyone to speak out. All these circumstances would just definitely suppress any hope. However, I think what's interesting and what's happening right now is that, yes, there is no political activities per se in like the conventional sense. However, we are back to a moment as that what we have been seeing at late 80s or the 90s, where there are battles that are being fought within some closed circle or inner circle of particular sectors of society. So for example, right now we are seeing workers' sit-ins and strikes. And that's remarkable having that under these circumstances. And that's happening because of the economic situation. The government is now liquidating many of the important companies, such as that of the iron and steel one. And you see that a week ago, 4,000 workers had a sit-in defying that decision. That's significant given the time. That's significant given that this is just about almost half of the people who are employed by this company. And to know that this is not the only case. There were sit-ins in Nag Hammadi, in Dahshur, in Kafr Dawar. All these places are in various governorates. And by the same token, you see other battles that are being fought in the area of women's rights, fighting really challenging cases in court about rape and sexual harassment. And it's significant because those who are being accused are from the upper class families and very powerful people in society. And also, of course, like the battle of freedom of the press, despite all the repression that is out there, you find that independent news sites are still fighting for that space. This is important because back in 2011, when These issues were brought to the forefront of the demands of the revolution. They were sidelined, the workers' demands were sidelined as what they called matalib fi'awiyya, or like sectoral demands. This is like sort of like diminishing the importance of it. This is like a marginal issue. Women who went to the square at some points to fight for the rights of women were beaten up in Tahrir Square, and they were told that this is not the time for this. So it is not the traditional sense of political resistance. However, within those circles, people are still fighting.
Ahmed, obviously, when any regime arrests and imprisons authors, which is what happened to you, then they have pretty much reached the peak on the autocracy scale. It's a depressing thought, but do you think it is the case that al-Sisi's rule is actually more repressive than Mubarak's was? Was it easier to be a novelist before the Arab Spring?
Of course. It's more repressive than Mubarak regime and even than Abdel Nasser regime, than Nasser regime. It's a repressive regime who doesn't have any plan. You see, like when you have a dictator, when you are designing a totalitarian regime, you need the propaganda machine to produce like ideology, to produce this illusion, okay, to put people into sleep. And during Mubarak time, he also was more interested in his image and his connection with Western country. So Mubarak has to play on the role. So he will do election. He will let opposition parties to participate in an election. The state itself will invest in culture and art and will let other organization, private organization or NGO working on field of art and literature to work freely in Egypt. But with Sisi regime now, he doesn't want anyone to speak. He doesn't care about his reputation. He doesn't care about his image. And his other strategy, no, I'm not going to give Western country a democratic theater, but I'm going to give them money. I'm going to buy a lot of weapons from them. And by spending money on Western country and buying their weapons, they will be silent. And then the other hand, locally, I will not let anyone speak. They are full control of parliament. They are full control of the media. All the media now is owned by the state or by the army directly. And even they will start to punish like artists and writers who will speak against them. They will start punish them by silencing them. And this like developed to now, like we have a very unique situation in Egypt that for the first time, all the most interesting one, like all the artists are living in Berlin. Most of writers are in exile all over the world. Most of thinkers and even like lecturers, university professors are living abroad or thinking about leaving the country. And finally, if you want to know what is happening in the Egyptian art scene, you will go to Berlin, not Cairo. So suddenly we start to feel like we are becoming an Iranian, you know, like the period when the Iranian art grows in exile. So now, like, we are all over the world in exile, and this is the only space to work freely. The opposite in Egypt, you will be forced to work with them. You will be forced to praise, like, Sisi and silence. It's so depressing. Like, when we are talking about, like, the culture scene in Egypt and the art scene, it's really so depressing.
Nancy, I want to further a point Ahmed made there, which was that Hosni Mubarak did at least pay a certain amount of lip service to the opinions of the outside world, particularly Egypt's allies in the United States. We do, of course, have a new administration in the United States. Do you perceive any hope there for al-Sisi being compelled to modify his behavior a bit if a new American administration makes it clear that they're not prepared to deal with him as things are?
Well, I think the current situation, having the Biden administration in power in the U.S., is a great improvement than the time of Trump, who has praised Sisi, called him his favorite dictator, encouraged his approach to repression. But now, having a leader who is supposedly like is more progressive, supportive of human rights and democracy, that's good news for Egypt, given that the U.S. has a lot of influence in the region and also is one of the biggest donors of Egypt. Like, we get 1.3 billion U.S. military aid annually. However, I think there is always this exaggerated and inflated influence of the foreign forces, whether from Europe or the U.S. or even regionally, on the internal affairs, because at the end of the day, the president is actually the one who is projecting the dominant narrative. He is suppressing the media and putting out a narrative that is not true. And actually, he is somehow doing the same thing as Mubarak did, is that he is always waving the scare ghost of chaos and radicalization if he lets things to be open. At the time of Mubarak, it was mostly a potential. Like, he would always say, like, if we open up, you will have terrorists and the Islamist country. And again, like, given what happened with the elections in Palestine and the results of it bringing, like, a more conservative Islamist in power, was a bit discouraging for a lot of people, and he used this to sort of discourage the push from abroad to push for democracy. However, Sisi is even luckier than Mubarak because he came at a time where ISIS rose in power and, like, established their, like, Islamic State, and that was very useful for him because anything is now blamed on the issue of terrorism. And that's from the side of the United States. From the side of Europe, he waves the card of refugees, saying that if things go out of hand, like Syria, Egypt is a 100 million people country. If those are unleashed, sort of a way, it's an extortionist approach. You wouldn't want to be in a situation that you have, like, a four times the crisis that happened in Syria.
We are coming to the end of the show now, and I want to try and, I guess, sum things up by refracting Egypt's last 10 years through your own personal experiences. And I guess the simplest way to do that is ask you each in turn if you can imagine circumstances under which it will be possible for you to go back and how that might come about. Ahmed, I'll ask you first. Is that something that seems possible to you?
It's not possible now, but, like, I wish at least I would be able to visit, to see my family and to visit my country. The big dream is that we get rid of Sisi and his regime, but I could lower my ambition a little bit, and I could say if we start to see pressure on this regime from United States and from Western country, and we start to see an effective pressure that will force him to move a little bit to have, like, more freedom and more dignity in justice system, maybe by then I could feel safe to visit for a short time. But until now, there is no any signs of any change in this regime.
And Nancy, the same question to you. Does going back to Egypt, either to visit or to live, seem to you like something that's imaginable in the near future?
Not in the near future. I, of course, want to visit, particularly because my 11-year-old twins are living there and I haven't seen them for 2 years now because of different circumstances in the COVID-19. But I want to go back where I would be safe and free and not a burden on the people around me, where they're, like, trying to get me out of jail. And that would not happen until I would have confidence in the judiciary and the rule of law and the justice system, that I would know that I would not go back and just be thrown in jail on trumped up charges. That's in terms of the state, but also I would like to go when the society is actually becoming more open. The government alone cannot repress people unless there is some resonance within the people. Nagy would not have been jailed and no one just, like, standing up for him if the population did not have this conservative cultures that accepts that something like that would be worth jailing. And sadly, that's a very difficult situation that people like Ahmed and myself and others, we're not also living in safe havens. We don't have stability. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Nancy O'Kale and Ahmed Naji, thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.